Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
We are the podcast of the S1 Project, and our mission is to bring moral philosophical reflection and humanistic theological reflection to questions having to do with our shared common life.
To get us beyond the binaries of politics and economics, which dominate so much of the conversation in the public square, but which do so little to move us towards a place of human flourishing or deeper understanding.
Our little opening covers a lot of ground in just a little bit of time. So if you want to learn more about the S1 Project, go to our website, s1project.org. Hey, Shana, we've got a spinny wheel that we spin at the beginning of our shows. It lands on one of 16 different core values and key ideas.
Shana, it's actually 32.
You're right, it is.
You've got two ideas on each one of the zones.
Oh, man.
32 ideas to choose from.
Thank you for that. I mean, math is so elegant. Like 8 times 2, no. Math is really elegant.
Math is really elegant, says the man who makes his living with words, not numbers. Okay, now we understand why.
We give the wheel a spin. It introduces some randomness to our show, some playfulness. The spinny wheel lands on one of 32 different core values and key ideas, and we do a riff. You know, I would like to spin the wheel. Would you let me?
Go for it. Sometimes you just feel like you got to spin the wheel. We're in an old farmhouse, and so the pallet that the spinny wheel is on is definitely listing, heading east, as they say.
The spinny wheel has landed on more interesting disagreement, which I love as a phrase. Well, I love all the phrases since I made them up, but more interesting disagreement. A lot of times in conversations about public questions, the default position is that we ought to aim for agreement or some kind of common ground. And of course, that's a good thing. Like, to argue against agreement and common ground is a little bit like arguing against kittens. So, but I think there's something provocative and perhaps fertile if we foreground disagreement rather than agreement. And I don't know what my intuition is about that, Shane. I'll try to put it into words, but I just feel like at least part of what holds us back in public conversations is a fear of disagreeing. Another thing that holds us back is, and maybe this is related to the fear, having the skills, the personal skills, how would you describe it? Skills, but maybe even character, even a certain way of approaching the world that can live with disagreement and enter into disagreement with other people in a creative way and be able to disagree and still maintain relationships, which I think is a really, that can be learned, but it takes a certain mindset.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you've said, and I would only add to it that I feel like that that ability to disagree, to not need to think alike in order to love alike, is such a cornerstone of democracy. Mm. That when we look at what's going on right now in the social fabric and the inability to speak across lines of agreement then leads to vilifying the other, and we end up where we are right now. Yeah. So bravo.
Yeah. So if you do go to the S1Project.org website, you will see our tagline right at the top is, let's disagree together.
Yes.
For good.
For good. For disagreeing good. For good.
Yeah.
The chime indicates that it is time for us to move on from the topic of our spinny wheel to the topic of our show today. Today we are talking about an article by Christine Emba that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. It's entitled, What Would Society Look Like If Extreme Wealth Were Impossible? It is an article on something that well, Christine calls, but apparently this has been out there written about by other people, something called limitarianism. Limitarianism. Limitarianism questions the idea that individual wealth is ever truly individual. And so the article goes on to explore that. It begins with a story about Ruth Gottesman, who was a former professor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and she was the widower of a very successful, very wealthy financier, David Gottesman. She recently donated to Albert Einstein College of Medicine $1 billion. And that gift came with some directions. The directions were that the money was to go to provide free tuition in perpetuity for those students attending Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Now, Chris, I have no problem, as neither does the writer of the article, with such a wonderful gift being made to an underendowed, underfunded medical school. That is a wonderful thing. It was a wonderful thing for Ruth to do. But the article goes on to question a few things, and that is not the least of which is that, I mean, while this gift certainly, let me say, as the New York Times columnist Gina Belafonte put it, Gottesman's giving broadcasts a message of how a billionaire might live his or her best life without terraforming Mars, without Burning Man, without the attempts to stealth run Harvard. You know, true. Yes, absolutely. Hands down. No argument there. But it begs the question, when we have this class of uber wealthy people in this country, they're making decisions about what's important and where to put the money. We, the people, we, the citizens of this nation, we have no vote. We have no oversight. We have, no ability to weigh in on that. So that's one problem with unlimited wealth, is that you've got the super wealthy class making these decisions for the rest of us. Let me throw it to you. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I just wanted to a brief rejoinder on this piece, which is, and you've explained it well. So Gottesman makes this generous gift that benefits all kinds of people out of her $3 billion worth of net worth. And of course, we're left saying, oh, that's great. That's great. What a great use of, if you're going to be uber wealthy, then that's a great use of your uber wealth. But then the question is it a good thing for a society to have people who have so much wealth?
And Chris, just to be clear, because the article also points out that her $3 billion of wealth does not even get her into the top 100 wealthiest people category, if you can even imagine that.
I know, that was breathtaking. For me, and I just share with you my experience of this, which is, there are lots of things that I think all of us walk around in society that we're aware of, but we don't really want to let sink in deeply into our consciousness, because it's problematic to try to think about it, or maybe it can lead to despair if we think of some of the problems in society. So to me, this is one of them. Just report my experience of this. I know that there are these uber wealthy people walking around, but I tend to keep that at arm's length because I feel like it's not something that I can meaningfully engage in. But here we are. You and I are now meaningfully engaged in this. And I think the question has to be asked exactly as the author of this article asks it, which is it a good thing? Can we think morally about whether we ought to have a society where individuals can accumulate this much wealth? Mm-hmm. And this ties into, of course, our theme of the year, which is the moral foundations of democracy. There's a way in which, and you've already alluded to it, where the existence of this uber wealthy class erodes democracy. Yeah.
It erodes democracy. Besides, I mean, and I'm not an economist, but my limited understanding of sort of national finances are that sort of at any given time, America has a certain amount of wealth. If 95% of that is held by less than 10% of the people, then what are the rest of the 95% of us supposed to live on? And I think most people listening to this podcast, if they stop to think about it, I mean, I would be considered, I think, by any stretch, middle class in America, and that's a diminishing group. But what does it mean to be middle class in America today? It means when your dishwasher breaks, you're out of a dishwasher because you don't have $160 to pay a guy just to walk into your house before they even do the work. You know, things are just so cattywampus and so screwed up.
So one of the things I find provocative about this article and thinking about this question is that it raises philosophical moral issues. One of them, Shane, I want to run past you, which is, and I think the author points to this tension, but isn't there something in our culture that recoils from the idea that we ought to restrain individuals from getting whatever they can get?
Well, yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up. I think this is a beautiful illustration of why you and I are doing what we're doing. We're trying to get the conversation beyond what? Economics and politics. Okay. So if the conversation ties our success, and it does in our culture, our success is very much tied to what financially we are able to achieve, then there should never be a restriction on anyone.
And that's a moral vision.
That is a moral vision.
Right?
I'm not sure we chose it.
That's it. I think people feel like it's inevitable. Like we've arrived where we are through some kind of inevitable evolution. And so we don't even question or even see that it's a moral choice.
Yeah.
Celebrate the individual acquisitiveness to without restraint.
It's the moral equivalency of boiled frog syndrome. You know, you put a frog in boiling water, it's going to jump out. But if you put the frog in warm water and gradually raise the temperature, frog doesn't notice what's going on. In the article, Christine quotes Dutch philosopher Ingrid Robbins. And she says, and Ingrid says, after a decade of analyzing and debating extreme wealth, I became convinced that we must create a world in which no one is super rich, that there must be a cap on the amount of wealth any one person can have. I call this limitarianism. But what she says is because extreme wealth keeps the poor poor and it expands inequality. The super rich undermine democracy through their outsized political influence and wreck the climate with their luxurious lifestyles. Yeah.
So she's articulating a different moral vision.
Right. But so, and I think what has happened throughout history and what I am very afraid will happen, perhaps not in yours in my lifetime, though it could, people will stay asleep for just so long. And at some point when the pressure becomes too great and people's backs begin to actually crack, there will be a revolution because people are fed up. They're fed up with policies. They're fed up with the choices we have for president, you know, in the upcoming election. People are pissed off and fed up at, you know, you give me the numbers and say, oh, but, you know, inflation and we avoided this, we avoided that. Well, I'm still spending $5 for a dozen eggs at the grocery store. Gas is still over $3 a gallon. Like, that is my worldview. And no one in Washington has a realistic worldview because they live in the Washington bubble. So that's the political side of it. But if we're going to move the conversation, and I think a peaceful way, better to do it now, better to start moving the conversation and ask the question. Does anyone deserve, and this is where, you know, this is where you got to pull the pieces out of the cultural muck. Because we have this whole thing in America about individualism, and you and I have spoken about toxic individualism. But the point the author is making in this article is that is individual wealth ever really individual? That It always depends on who you are, where you were born, what was... A child born in Gaza today has abso-freaking-lutely no chance to become uber wealthy. Zero, not a zilch. Doesn't matter how hard they work. Doesn't matter how smart they are. They were born into a war-torn country, and it is going to be at least a generation between before that country is back up and functioning, if it ever can be. And I honestly don't know at this point, okay? In America, if you are born into the owning class, then chances are you inherited something. Perhaps it was a business. Perhaps it was property. And businesses are not held accountable these days for exploitation that is toxic to the people, to the environment, to the culture. So I think I want to just sort of say to our listeners, like, pay attention. This is a crucial, we should be having this conversation. We should be having a conversation that is somewhat based on entitlement. And I don't mean entitlement of the rich and well, you know, the rich and famous. I mean, like, Super Bowl Sunday, right? Okay, so football, oh, America's great pastime. What was the big story? Whoa, was Taylor Swift's private jet going to have room to park at the airport because of all the private jets that were there? You know, the Super Bowl isn't for people like you and me. It's for the uber wealthy. We can't even get there anymore. I can't even afford to buy tickets for a football game down at Gillette Stadium anymore, much less, you know, try to go see a Boston Red Sox game or these little things where they're getting nibbled away at. And we can wake up now before we're super pissed, or we can let the giant sleep until it wakes up with a roar. And I shudder to think what happens at that point. I really do.
Yeah, this sense that you've brought up about, I'm going to coin a noun, fed-upness.
Fed-upness.
Being fed up. And
I'm fed up. Are you fed up?
It reminds me of a friend of the S1 Project, Dwayne David Paul. He's got a project called Religion in Revolt, and we did a interview with him earlier in the year. And he's a writer, and a lot of the focus of his writing is simply on this question, which is people having difficulty just getting by economically with the bare necessities, just the struggle to live.
The struggle to make ends meet.
Yeah. So I wanted to say that. I loved, again, you did a great job recapping the article and how Ingrid Robbins, who's this philosopher, talks about how individuals accumulating wealth don't do it individually. It depends on connections.
Yeah, connections, roadways.
Right.
Where geographically are you? What is the weather? What kinds of natural disasters are you facing? Right. I mean,
which is this is a moral vision of the human being.
It's absolutely.
Like it sees the human being as embedded, not as isolated.
Not as isolated, as embedded, but more than just the human being, the human soul. It puts a value. Yeah. There is no point, really, in our living here simply to struggle and to have to work this hard, to labor and to live in this chaos. That is not, I don't believe that is why we're here. But as long as we're having to work this hard, are we ever going to be able to get to the next place?
Yeah, yeah. So that is... That articulates a different kind of moral vision, which is what is the end or purpose of human life, which this article touches on. And I did want to get to that in a second. But so here's a question, Shana. What story might you tell? And I can share with you my story or how I would tell it. How change happens. What's the S1 Project theory of change? But let's back away from that so grand. And let's say, what's Shana's theory of change? What's Chris's theory of change? I don't have a complete theory, but I feel like one key piece of making change is the moment when you recognize that the way things are not inevitable. And how that happens is by what we're doing, which is conversing, but conversing to the end of imagining a different world. I think that's the beginning of change, because otherwise we're stuck in this sense of inevitability, that this is the way it's always going to be, and there's nothing that can change.
Fatalism.
If you have that, then there is no chance.
Yeah.
But if you start articulating a different vision that is grounded in a moral, again, it's grounded in the moral vision of what human beings are and what they and what we can be. So that's my a beginning of a theory of change.
I absolutely could not have said that better myself. And that was exactly what I was thinking when you asked the question. Throughout history, it seems there have always been those people who came along and who saw something different, something possible. They relocated the economy, if you will. And I don't mean that simply financially, but that which is of value, you know, they relocated it. And they got some people to sign on, right? And then that group rolled on and picked up some other people, you know, and like a snowball, just the movement continues to grow. So, you know, we've had those movements throughout history, both here in America and around the world. And, I don't know who the next prophet is. I mean, hell, maybe it's you and me. Who knows? That's a scary thought. But, it's certainly what we're up to, and I'm not really shy about that. And I think in, you know, my studies of the life of the historical Jesus, that's my understanding of exactly what he came to do. He came into a world, saw people being crushed both by a brutal occupation and an imperialist mentality that just left no room for anybody's humanity. And he came along and said, you can free yourselves. You, to quote a line from The Wizard of Oz, you had the magic, the power was with you always. What are your eyes looking at? Where is your heart focused? Used to be the role of religion, right? To ground people in a sense of a greater common good. And in the absence of that, it's sort of become every man for himself, but it doesn't have to stay that way.
Yeah. Before you mentioned religion in the biblical account, I was thinking religion in the biblical account.
Of course you were. Because great minds think alike.
Of imagining as the source of our ability to imagine a different way. And so I'm glad you brought that up. The end of the article, Shana, I wrote down this quote. Basically, she says, a society, this is the author of the article, not the philosopher Robbins, who's been quoted throughout the article. This is the author. She says, a society with limits on wealth will have to develop new aspirations. Now is as good a time as any to dream new dreams. Interesting. I didn't even register, but she's talking about dreaming new dreams. That automatically takes me to the Reverend Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a dream. Different context. Well, different context.
Another prophet
but still
who came and had a different vision.
Yeah.
And said we don't all need to be at the back of the bus, right?
Right.
Started a movement. Okay,
yeah,
there we go.
Yeah. So a society with limits on wealth will have to develop new aspirations. Interesting, she uses the word aspirations. I would like to translate that into moral philosophical language, which is to say a society with limits on wealth will have to develop new ideas of the good to which we are aiming. The society we live in now just accepts that unbridled individual acquisition of wealth is a good. But if we cap it, then what's the new good that replaces it? And we've articulated that in the last half hour. Your thoughts, if you want to pick up
well,
on any
just
of that.
Well, just to emphasize the point.
Yeah.
You know, that we have to begin thinking in new ways. Certainly folks who are engaged in environmental preservation are and have been aware of this for quite some time. I know there are all kinds of farmers out there who are doing, you know, there was sustainable farming was the thing for a while, and now it's restorative farming. Farming in such a way as to actually restore, to actually care for the earth while allowing the earth or encouraging the earth to put forth some resources for you, but not like then to just pillage and plunder the earth for everything it can possibly cough up until you've destroyed the soil, destroyed the land, polluted the surrounding waters, et cetera, et cetera. So there are people, like I said, there are people in pockets who are certainly waking up and have been awake for a long time to those new aspirations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are people practicing, practitioners, and there are people thinking as well to raise the to raise up the possibility of a different moral imagination of what's possible. The possibility of what's possible. We'll
take it. The possibility of what's possible, yes. Possibility of possibility.
Oh my goodness.
Is infinite.
Are we there? I think we're there. I'm
there. We're there. We're there. It was good.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light.
Thank you, friends, for tuning in to another edition of What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project. We are here by virtue of the generosity of folks just like you who give to us at Patreon.
Shana, what a pleasure to spend this time with you and again to think theologically and philosophically about these important questions. Thank you, Shana.
Thank you, Chris.